Okay, our typical view of the Makos is punitive. The Egyptians abused Am Yisrael, persecuted Am Yisrael. Every crime has its punishment, and the Egyptians are being slowly punished, slowly humiliated. Their will is being broken. It's not just punitive, but it's to break the strong-willed refusal to discharge the Jewish people to the desert. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in many ways toying with Paro. But there are too many different colors and too many different varieties of Makos, and the sequencing is obviously too important just to allow it to be a one-dimensional, even a two-dimensional experience of punitive and breaking the will of Paro. Excuse me. What I want to try to share with you is some of the larger themes, the larger agendas of the Makos. And these themes sometimes play out in many unique sequences. Most famous sequencing is the sequencing of Rabbi Yehuda, the Tzach Hadash B'Achav, and we oftentimes, very almost instinctively, build a 3-3-4 structure. But there are endless and limitless, not limitless, but certainly many, many different sequencing beyond just the 3-3-4, and there could be inner dynamics and inner correspondence between several Makos, not necessarily following the order of the 10 Makos. So I want to describe 4 or 5 of the larger themes. Let me take a booklet, Yoni, maybe, make sure people come and take a look at some of the larger themes in the Makos beyond just punishing Paro and breaking his will. The first theme, obviously, is theological. Paro, Mitzrayim, the center of ancient culture, center of ancient religious culture. And they worshipped many different gods, many different deities. And part of the Makos is to attempt to debunk some of the various deities which the Egyptians and which Paro worshipped. Now, some of them may be obvious to you. The Egyptians worshipped Osiris, they worshipped Ra, which is the sun god. So obviously having the sun eclipsed for an entire week or close to a week, 3 days and 3 days, was an attempt to debunk or to repudiate the divine essence which Egyptians attributed to these gods, to the sun and to the planets. Dever, Egyptians worshipped cattle, that's why the Jews were uncomfortable eating alongside the Egyptians. That's why the Jews as cattle herders may not have been so attracted to the Egyptians. So Dever is an opportunity to slaughter the Egyptian cattle. But many of you may not be so aware that the process, and I call it a process of Dam and Tzfardea, was an attack on one of the most, if not the most prominent Egyptian deities, and that's the Nile River. The Nile River was the ancient Egyptian source of irrigation. It allowed them to weather the famines in the end of Sefer Bereishis. The fact that there was little rainfall in the rest of the sub-Saharan continent, but Egypt had irrigation and they were able to dig the ore to irrigate their lands. In fact, when the Torah describes Eretz Yisrael as not possessing this constant water source available, take a look at Source 1, Part Beis, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us in Eretz Yisrael, you're more dependent upon the constant rainfall. Hashem reminds us, Ki Eretz Asher Ta Basham Malarishta, the land you're entering, Eretz Yisrael, this is told to them in the desert, Lo Keretz Mitzrayim Hi. It's not like Eretz Mitzrayim, Asher Yitzasa Misham, Asher Tizra Azaracha, V'Hishkisa V'Raglacha. Human invention, human intuition, V'Raglacha. You can irrigate, you can water your land, Kigan Hayarak, like a garden of vegetables or a garden of flowers. So Egypt was the epitome. This gave them economic might, this gave them cultural pride, this gave them military force, this gave them economic right, which was able to be transferred to military force. And by converting the source of life into the source of death, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is first and foremost debunking the Nile as a major symbol of an Egyptian deity. If you look carefully, that's why the encounter between HaKadosh Baruch Hu, more specifically between Moshe and Aaron and Paro, takes place at the Nile. Source number 1, Part Aleph. Lechel Paro Baboker. You should encounter him, deliver the warning, while he's visiting the Or. And why did Paro visit the Or every morning? So you all know the funny, comical medrash that Paro visited the Or in the morning because he wanted to deny his humanity. He presented himself to the Egyptian population as a deity. He didn't have to relieve his biological waste. They went to the bathroom in the morning, and in the evening when no one was watching, so Moshe was catching him at a vulnerable moment, humiliating moment, so we could have the leverage on Paro. It's not the simple pshat, and certainly not the pshat Chazal provided in the Medrash. What does Paro get up every morning to the Or? It's a religious ceremony. When a king wakes up, when a noble monarch wakes up, That is a religious ceremony. In ancient Europe, people would actually attend the waking of the sun with a double entendre, S-U-N and S-O-N. They would watch the sun rise. And this was a moment in which divine happenings were occurring. The divine essence was now rising to lord over the people. So Paro went every morning to the Yaor for a religious ceremony by the banks of the Yaor to give praise, to offer a sacrifice, to pray by the Yaor. And Moshe is basically surprising him. He's setting a trap. He's setting an ambush for him at the Yaor. If you look, I tried to highlight all the times the Yaor is mentioned in section number one, description of Dam. Sometimes we simplify the Makkah of Dam as the elimination of water sources, and we'll talk about this later. But in addition to the elimination of water sources, it was an attack on the Yaor. In fact, according to the Abar Benel, a very famous Abar Benel, Moshe and Aaron each performed different parts of the miracle. One, Aaron was involved in trying to convert all the water to Dam. Moshe was involved in attacking the Yaor. So Moshe encounters Paro during this religious ceremony early in the morning by the Yaor. And Hashem tells him, V'hamateh, source number one, part Aleph, line two, Hamateh asher nehapach l'nachash, tikach v'yodecha. Take the staff, but Hashem reminds him, this is the staff which earlier, in Parshas Va'era, I converted into a nachash. So it's very important for Moshe to be holding a staff, to be holding a mateh at the Nile, and that should be the mateh which was earlier converted into a nachash. Why? Because the debasing of the Nile is really a three-stage process. Because part of worshipping the Nile was not just worshipping the Nile per se, but worshipping the creatures of the Nile, worshipping these reptiles that show up in hieroglyphs and on tombs and show up on Paro's decorations and on his clothing and on his crown. So first converting a stick, a plain, ordinary stick, into a reptile, into a tanin, was the first attempt to show that all these creatures that you worship, even a twig can become a creature. You worship them, you revere them, you look up to them. I can turn a twig, I can turn a mateh into a creature. Mateh she nepach li tanin. Now it's verdeh, but a tanin, tikach v'yadecha. The second stage is turning the source of life, namely the Nile River, running water, agriculturally significant, providing the food source for the Egyptians, turning it into a stagnant pond of blood. And notice carefully what happens to the Yaor. Mehadagar shebayor tamus, line number three, the fish all die. So something which is a source of life, and we'll talk about the role of the fish later, but you've got fish dying in the Nile, water being converted into blood, blood probably being thicker than water, so only the flow of the Nile slowing down, if not ceasing entirely. What happens when you have a Nile River that used to be full of fish and streaming and healthy, and now it's full of blood and dying fish? What happens? It starts to smell. It starts to rot. And the Torah makes a point of this. Source number one, second to last line, Vayivash Hayor. The Yaor starts to smell. V'lo yachlu Mitzrayim l'shtos mayim min Hayor. They can't drink from the Yaor. Not just can they no longer drink from the Yaor, they can't even get close to the Yaor. So a previous deity now is smelling so terrible, is so odorous, is so offensive, it's a sewer. Full of blood, full of dead fish carcasses, Uvash Hayor. So what happens naturally is the third stage, when you take a source of fresh water and you turn it into a pond that smells and is stagnant and produces smell. What grows in ponds? Smardeh, frogs. Frogs grow in ponds and other types of rodents, and other types of mosquitoes. And so the transitioning of the Nile reaches its full climax with its Smardeh. So now that Smardeh, source number two, Visharetz Hayart Smardeim, notice the word Visharetz. Anyone know what the word Visharetz reminds you of? Where does the Torah use Visharetz? Okay, it's in Parsha Shmini, but where else before Parshas? Bereishis. Yishritzu Hamayim, Sheretz Lemineu. So the word Yishritzu, the verb of Yishritzu, was employed in Bereishis as the growth of life, the production of life. The water should produce Sheretz Ha'ov, Sheretz Ha'dagim, it should produce life. Here, this stagnant, smelly pond, the blood, which is already offensive in the Makkah of Dam, now is producing Svardim, which normally develop and habitate stagnant ponds rather than fresh water. And the Makkah ends, Vayitzburo sam chamarim chamarim, they gather all these heaps of dead carcasses, or Svardeya, Vativ Asha Aretz. Now it's no longer the Yaor that smells. What smells now? The banks of the Yaor. So now you can't even get close to the banks of the Yor. Beforehand, uvash hayor. The Yor was smelly. The Yor was odorous. At this point, bativash haaretz. Now the land surrounding. So they can't get near, anywhere near the radius of the Yor. It's now been completely converted through a three-step process of debasing this Egyptian deity of the Nile River. That's why the introduction and the warning to Makas Dam is so theological. Why do some Makos have warnings? Some Makos not have warnings. So we'll talk about that. But very often the warnings in the Makos are to elucidate the latent theological messages inherent in those Makos. You may not know what those messages are. I'll teach you what to learn or what to study in these Makos. So if you look in the story of Dam, Shem tells Moshe to meet Paro at the Or, meet him beneath Saftad Lekrasal, Svasayor, take your Mateh, and what's the warning? Bezos Teda Kiani Hashem. This is even meant to break Paro's will so that you'll suffer, or you won't have water to drink, or you want to expel or emancipate the Jewish people. I want to teach you that the Nile isn't your God, that I am your God. Bezos Teda Kiani Hashem. So one agenda, which is picked up later, we talked before about Choshech, we talked before about Dever. But to begin to see this two-part makkah of Dam and Svardea, not just as a punishment or a penalty, and not just as breaking Paro's will so that he'll release the Jewish people, but repudiating, debunking Egyptian deity. This view, this view is stressed by a pasuk in Yechezkel. So let's take a look, because if you look in Tanakh, how these makos are redistilled and reconfigured, you see certain messages about the makos that you can't necessarily appreciate in Sefer Shemos. If you look in Yechezkel, Perek Chavtes, I quoted it, source 2, part days, in the end of Tzvardei, you could have just as easily seen at the end of Dam. Daber v'yamarta, ko amar Hashem, hinani alacha paro melech Mitzrayim, I am upon you, Paro. So now there's an attack not just against the Egyptians, but against Paro, who sees himself as Hatanim Hagadol Haravetz Bitochi Arav. Paro self-envisioned, self-fashioned himself as a great Tanim, a great crocodile or Nile creature, crouching in the Nile. Asher Amar, this crocodile or Nile creature says, Li Ori, I am the Nile. Ani Asitini, I have fashioned it. One of the signature elements of paganism is Ma'asa Yidei Adam. In a monotheistic religion, there's a hierarchy. What does Hashem expect of you? In a paganistic religion, what can my God do for me? So the Nile was subjugated to Paro. Paro saw himself as a God-king, crouching in the Nile, controlling the technology, controlling the irrigation, controlling the life force of the Nile. There's a merging between the Nile as an inanimate object and Paro as a God-king of that Nile. Li Ari, Ani Asitini. I have transformed. Remember, in Judaism and transcendent monotheism, there's a real gap between human and God. In paganism, Ma'aseh De'Adam. Humans adopt God and deify themselves. Look at Haman walking around with an idol around his neck, becoming the idol, deifying himself. So what does Hashem do to Paro? Listen to what happens. Source number 2, part days. V'nasati chachim bilchayacha. I'll put hooks into your cheeks. Namely, I'll fish you out of the Nile. You're a Nile creature. I will fish you out and put hooks into your cheeks. V'hidbakti degasi orecha bekaski sosecha. And the fish of the Nile will cling to your scales. As I pull you out, all these dead fish will be drawn out with you, clinging to your scales. So the fish are no longer swimming through the Nile, providing life and reflecting a life source of water, but everything has died, and the creature has been fished out of the Nile. These fish are clinging, perhaps attached by the blood. And I'll draw you out of the Or. And then the repetition is called degasi orecha bekas kisosecha. So interesting, this fishing metaphor isn't really something which stacks up identically to Dam or Tzvardea. There is no Dam in this description of Tzvardea. There are no Tzvardim per se. But if you put Dam and Tzvardea together, the death of the Nile, the stinking, rotting Nile, taking the deity, taking the deification of the Nile out of the Nile in the personage of Paro, so Yechezkel is a broader summary of what Dam and Svardea accomplished. So Dam and Svardea are the first volley of attacking Egyptian paganism, Egyptian theology, Egyptian deities. There are other deities that are assaulted, Dever and Choshech in particular, But to be able to see Dam and Tzvardeh not as a removal of water source, but as an attack on a very symbolic part of Egyptian theology. Benji?
So you see Dam and Tzvardeh as a cycle. So people postulated that you could maybe say that Dam and Tzvardeh was red tide and the result of it. Is it like wrong to see it as that, because it wouldn't hold by all the Midrashim that there was no water anywhere else in Mitzrayim?
It seems like the other waters were affected, but there's some waters that weren't affected. Like they were able to dig some ditches. So I'm not. Your question is an important question. I'm not sure how much it touches upon my issue. Even if it's a red tide, so at least in people's perception, they couldn't drink the water anymore. It looked like that. And keep in mind, this is also the burial ground of the Jews. This is where they'd bury Jewish babies. So to be able to convert that into a source of at least either actual dam or perceived dam, it certainly was very symbolic and very jarring to the Egyptians. Okay, now, the second part, the second agenda of the Makos is not just to debase Egyptian theology, but to introduce monotheism. This is a brand new message. Avram had lived it for about 100, 200 years, and then the Jews descended to Mitzrayim, and they were trying to promulgate this message. Part of Yetzias Mitzrayim is not just the freeing of a people, but the freeing of a people who will accept the Torah at Har Sinai, and will start to teach the world the lesson that Baruch Hashem has proliferated throughout our entire world. You take it for granted. We live in a monotheistic world. We live in a world of morality. We live in a world of monotheism. It was not true. It was not true 2,000 years ago. It was not true 3,000 years ago. This is the Jewish triumph. By and large, and the Ramban says this clearly, we're happy that Christianity and Islam lifted Jewish ideas, corrupted them, but lifted them and spread them across the entire planet. It's not our purpose to be traveling to the outer missionaries of China and South America and spread the gospel. So Christianity and Islam were, to a degree, agents of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a certain way, forget the militantism, forget the anti-Semitism, to spread monotheism. And by and large, we live in a world of monotheism. What are some of the basics of monotheism that are on display in the Makos? How are they introduced, and where are they introduced? So what are the basics of monotheism as opposed to paganism? First of all, creation. Creation ex nihilo. Where does creation ex nihilo begin in the Makos? Remember, Dam and Tzvardeh are not Makos. I don't even want to use the word plagues, because plagues suggest punitive. They're not displays of creation. They're displays of conversion. Converting water to blood. Converting a docile Nile into one in which Tzvardeh, or according to some Rishonim, alligators, it wasn't just Tzvardeh, it was alligators and crocodiles, are roaming the entire Egyptian. But these were not creatures that hadn't been seen before. These were creatures that lived in the Or, that were tamed, that generally remained in the Or, and all of a sudden the Or was charetz, the Or produced great volumes of these Nile creatures that overran the Egyptian society. But if you look very carefully, when the Maka is reversed and the Maka is terminated, as opposed to the some of the other Makos, in particular, I'll mention Arba, because Arba and Tzvardeh have very strong similarities. What happened to the Arba? Anyone know? They're removed by a wind from all of Egypt. What happens to the Tzvardeh? Source number two, Rak Bayor Tisharna. They remain in the Or. Namely, they didn't die. They didn't disappear. They just went back to their home. They went back to their Nior. So nothing was created in Dam. It was converted. Nothing was created ex nihilo in Tzvardeh. The first stirrings of ex nihilo creation begin in Canaan. First stirrings, where you have something, you are converting Afar into Canaan. If you look carefully, Torah writes, Vatiyah Kinam Ba'adamu Va'beima, call Afar Ha'aretz Hayah Kinam. The entire earth, the entire land was filled with Canaan. And that's part of the reason why the Chartumim couldn't replicate that Makkah. So the first Makkah, the third Makkah, which was the first Makkah they were incapable of replicating, because their magic was based on ancient paganism. Their ancient paganism was based on material conversion. This wasn't conversion. This was generating Kenan. It was generating small-sized Kenan, as Rashi points out. So the first notion of creating something out of an abyss, out of an absence of material, begins in Kenan. But where some of the themes of monotheism begin to really emerge is in the Makkah of Barad. And if you look carefully, that's why Barad's introduction is also so theological, similar to Dam's introduction. If you look at the introduction to Barad, Shem says, Hashkem Baboker, wake up in the morning, visit Paro, so he also wakes up in the morning to deliver this theological message. Notice this doesn't take place by the Nile, because this isn't an attack on the Nile. It takes place in Paro's palace. Ki bapam hazos ani sholachas kol magefosai el lipcha uvavadecha uviamecha ba'avur teda. I want you to know ki ein kamoni b'chal haaretz, that I'm unique, that I'm transcendent, that I'm monotheistic. What are some of the messages of monotheism that are on display and borrowed uniquely? Well, first of all, it's really the first time during the Makos that people are starting to look to the heavens. Remember, most of the Makos until Shchin and Barad are grounded. You're looking down at the Nile. You're looking down at the Tzvardeh coming from the Nile. You're looking down at the earth. You're looking lateral at animals dying or the Arov invading. All of a sudden, something very interesting happens. Beginning with Shchin, primarily with Barak, continuing with Arba and Choshech, all of a sudden people's eyes are towards the heaven. Why did Moshe have to conduct that magic trick of throwing up soot and creating Shchin? Part of it was to lift people's attention to heaven. That Hashem is not imminent in our world. He's not a pagan god. It's Masi Deyad. I mean, he inhabits the heavens, at least in the transcendent hierarchy. And Barak, of course, reinforces that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends his messengers or sends his plagues from heaven. So first you see a redirection of human attention from either a downward-looking vector, a lateral vector, to an upward-looking sight that HaKadosh Baruch Hu inhabits the heavens. You see creation. You see creation of two of the primary elements of our universe, fire and water. But what you also see is you see coexistence of opposites. Fire and water normally can't coexist. In Barad, as the Torah writes, source number 7, line number 5, Vahi Barad Vaesh Mislakachas Bitocha Barad. Fire and water. Why is that important? Because in polytheistic or paganistic cultures, every single part of our world is attributed its own deity, because the god of light can't be the god of darkness, and the god of water can't be the god of fire, and the god... Do you know how many deities there are in Indian, in modern-day Indian religion? Anyone want to take a guess? How many different gods are there?
400.
In Hinduism. In Indian Hinduism today. 33 million different gods. Every item, object, or human face has a god attached to it, because humans process experience in divided terms. It's, we're all divided, you and you and you, and we process our lives that way, so we process our gods. If we're paganists, we just project our own cellular view of the world onto our gods. So there's a god of light, and a god of spring, and a god, and 33 million of them, because we could probably make a list of 33 million moments of human experience. Hashem is trying to tell them, there's one god. And I'm a god who's capable of fire and water coexisting within the bara. So this is a obvious message to us, but it's not so obvious to Egyptian paganists, that their bara can contain two opposites. But what's also interesting is not just does bara contain two natural opposites, fire and water, it also contains two moral opposites. What do I mean by two moral opposites? The god that punished also rescued. This was the first Makkah, the only Makkah in which Egyptians were specifically spared by following the word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What does Hashem say? Source number 7, line 3. Hayareis Tevar Hashem. If you fear my word, take your animals inside, go indoors, Hainisis Avadav, Ves Mikneu, Elabatim. And they were rescued. Chafalef. Vasher lo samli baal Tevar Hashem, those who didn't listen to Hashem's warning, and they were slaughtered. What does this mean? A god of mercy and a god of anger? A god of hail and a god of compassion? A god of good, so to speak, and a god of evil? That is completely incomprehensible to the pagan mind. Theodicy is what rips most religions apart. How could God be good and be evil? How could there be evil in the world? Christianity, even one of the most sophisticated monotheistic religions, makes a terrible, terrible concession to this. The inability to explain theodicy, how could an all-knowing, all-powerful God allow evil to exist in the world, forces Christianity to allocate evil to the devil. The devil is a rebel angel who disagrees with God, and he's the reason for evil in our world. He tries to seduce your soul to the kingdom of hell, away from the kingdom of heaven. That leads to the entire collapse of religion. Because the second that you admit there's another force, you start to strip away God's omnipotence. And once God becomes less omnipotent, the whole thing caves in. God is human and God is limited. Our God is completely omnipotent. There is no other creature in this world with any will of its own other than human beings. Satan is not a diabolical force. Satan is a malach hasharis. And the Satan's job every day is to confuse you, because if your freedom of choice were to be unchallenged and you'd see everything as clearly as you see it the night of Yom Kippur, then your freedom of choice would be lame. So the job of Satan is to challenge you, to make you weak, to make you distracted, to make you to ruin your focus. So your freedom of choice is hard fought and hard earned and meaningful. And he gets up every day and begins the day by saying Shira to Hashem. He says Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh with the other Malachim. He isn't a Satan with a pitchfork and a tail and two horns on his head. He's a Malach Hashem Asharis. So Barad is an opportunity to display not just the God of fire and ice, or fire and water, but the God of evil or punishment, not of evil, the God of punishment, and the God of rescue and compassion. So Barad is really where people are starting to look to Shemayim, starting to see creation ex nihilo. They're seeing creation and coexistence of opposites, opposites in the natural sphere, opposites in the moral sphere. So part of the Makos is not just to debase or to repudiate Egyptian theology, but part of it is to introduce monotheism. And one of the big theories of monotheism is that Hashem isn't physical. We talked about one versus many. We talked about creator versus converter. One of the fundamental paradigms of monotheism is that Hashem isn't physical. Now, you say this every year during the Haggadah, but you don't even know you're saying it. You don't even stop to think. We recite the pasuk in Parshas Kisav, Avayetzienu Hashem Elokeinu Mitzrayim, Biyad Chazaka, Uvizra Netuya, Uvimara Gadol, Uviyosos, Uvimofsin. Does anyone remember the drasha of Chazal, which we recite in the Haggadah every year? Biyad Chazaka refers to a very specific makkah. Does anyone know which one? Biyad Chazaka? Anyone remember? Zohar Dever. Very good. Zohar Dever. And we quote the pasuk in Vayera, because when they saw Dever, the Egyptian magician said, Hine Yad Hashem, Hoya B'miklecha. So for some reason, Dever is identified as the Yad Hashem. Why? What makes Dever so important? What makes Dever more important than any other Amaka that it's identified as Yad Hashem? The answer is as follows. Out of all the Makos, which was the most invisible Maka? A trick question, because there are two. Which had no palpable element to it. It was completely invisible. Don't say Choshech, because Choshech had palpable darkness. V'yamesh Choshech, you could actually feel darkness. Which were the two Makos that were invisible? The Charot and Dever. You just saw animals dying. You didn't see water being converted to blood. You didn't see Tzvardea roaming the countryside. You didn't see gangs of animals attacking. You didn't see soot turning into boils. You just saw animals mysteriously dying in microbial infection. There's nothing physical, which is why the magicians, again, couldn't reproduce it. Hashem is trying to say, this is my hand. When I say Yad Hashem, that my hand's going to afflict you. You know what the average Egyptian thought? Yad Hashem? You see this big hand with bones coming down from Shemayim, scooping you up and picking you, because that's how pagans process Yad Hashem. And Hashem was taunting the Egyptians. I'm going to send my Yad Hashem, and you're not going to see anything. You're not going to see anything, because I'm not physical. My Yad is something that your mind, his entire inner world, is invisible to you, and also invisible. So Dever was the first moment that HaKadosh Baruch Hu introduced them to one of the main principles of theology, that Hashem isn't visible. That's why it's called Yad Hashem, to taunt them. My Yad will descend, but you won't see anything. And that's why Moshe, the second time that Yad Hashem is used, in the final pasuk of the Torah, L'chol ha'yad ha'chazakah, l'chol ha'marah gadol, asher asa Moshe l'nei kol Yisrael, Chazal darshim that term, Yad Hashem, to be b'charis. So the term Yad Chazakah appears in Kisavo, Chazal say that's Dever. When the term Yad Chazakah appears in Parshas V'zosa Bracha, Chazal say, oh, that's Makos Bacharis. Because these were the two invisible Makos. And Hashem was trying to convince Egypt, and by Egypt, an entire world of paganists, that I'm not physical. So the second agenda of the Makos is not just to debunk Egyptian deities, but to introduce humanity to some of the basic guidelines of monotheism. Creation, one versus many, inhabiting the heavens, transcendence rather than immanent in human affairs, and non-physical, ein lo guf, V'lo yasiguhu masig yakov. Yes.
Why did he go through such an intricate process? Why didn't he just do it through revelation?
I think revelation is something that Hashem is reserving for the Jewish people, mass revelation. That becomes our calling card throughout history. We're the only people that Hashem decided to reveal himself to in mass. So Hashem is performing this through signs, through moments, through experiences, but revelation requires a certain level of being selected, a certain level of purity the Egyptians just don't require. Okay? Yes, Ella?
Is transcendence really such a unanimously agreed upon value within the Jewish belief system? I feel as if within certain sects in particular, an immanent God is definitely stressed or emphasized. So,
within Jewish?
Yeah. Like Hasidut, or are you talking about a different type of immanent?
Right, there certainly is a balance between immanence and transcendence, and in some sects of Kabbalah, there's a greater tilt towards immanence, but no one abdicates transcendence entirely. No one abdicates the infinity of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There may be interfaces by which we interact with HaKadosh Baruch Hu that are more immanent. But Hashem himself isn't solely immanent. Okay? Now, there's a third agenda. And this third agenda isn't religious and theological. It's much more socioeconomic. It's trying to tear apart the source of the Egyptian strength, the source of the Egyptian pride. And as I mentioned before, it's really important to read Parshas Shmos Va'erin Bo amidst the backdrop of Parshas Vayeshev Miketz Vayegash Vayechi. How did Egypt achieve their power? How did they achieve their world dominance? How did they achieve their economic might? Because they fed an entire planet. They were the breadbasket of the entire world. And they obviously could feed themselves. So dismantling Egyptian pride, it would be the equivalent. Okay, I don't want to say this Chas V'Shalom. I want you to take it in the right way. When Lahavdil, Elif Alfei Havdalos, when a terrorist wants to strike at the heart of America, he strikes at Wall Street. Because that's the economic, commercial capital, Madison Avenue of the world. And he wants to strike at the core, the symbolic core of that country's power, that country's might. So the core of the Egyptian might was the ability to feed themselves and to feed others. And slowly you see this ability unraveling. We spoke before about the Makah of Dam. The Makah of Dam was a two-pronged attack on the Egyptian breadbasket. On the one hand, it eliminated the water source, so they could no longer carry out the irrigation, which we read about before, the ability, Kigan Hashem, Keretz Mitzrayim, Sheshkish Shabarag L'chav. But what died during the Makah of Dam? Fish. Where do we see that Egyptians ate fish? It was obvious, because if you live near the Nile, you can eat a lot of fish, especially if you don't eat meat, because you worship cattle. But where did we see they eat fish?
The Jews
in Parshas Baloscha. Very good, Moshe. Parshas Baloscha. Source number one, part three. Zacharnu, part gimel, Zacharnu es hadaga asher nochal b'Mitzrayim chinam. Imagine it was a delicacy. Imagine the daily fare was carbohydrates, breads, dips, etc. But the fish was certainly something they were very fond of. They were remembering and they were nostalgic about. They missed it, Zacharnu es hadaga. So it'd be the equivalent of saying that in our society we can still eat, but no one has any meat. We're now eating chickens and fish, but all meat has disappeared from the modern table. So this water is now limited. The crops are going to die sooner rather than later. The fish have been removed from the sea. And what happens with Tzvardea? Now you'd think Tzvardea has really no impact upon the Egyptian breadbasket. But the Torah makes a point of telling us how far did the Tzvardea spread? So where did the Tzvardea spread? Source number two, part Aleph. V'sharat hayar Tzvardim, v'aluva v'vesecha. They were nuisance. Chadar mishkatcha, your bedroom. They were croaking. Al mitasecha v'vesa v'adecha. And where else? Uvetanurecha, uvimisharasech. The frogs invaded your ovens. Why is it important? Because once the frogs invaded the ovens, they couldn't cook anymore. So now they're eating raw food. Because the frogs invaded the ovens. I don't see anyone here from the five towns. Akiva, maybe you can tell some people. But I remember visiting some of the Long Island communities after Hurricane Sandy, in which literally the ocean just washed in into residential areas. For months and months, it smelled like a marine. It smelled like an ocean. I mean, you couldn't function. You couldn't get to fumigate the buildings, even after the ocean had washed out. People found dead fish in their basements, but even if they didn't find dead fish. So it was a while until the Egyptians began to cook again. It wasn't just a one-week episode in which the frogs were creating a nuisance and they went out and bought some bread at the bakeries. They basically shut down their ability to cook and to bake. So it's not as if people are starving. That will happen later. with two very, very pivotal makos, but they're certainly not eating as well as they used to eat. Now, a very interesting makah occurs. It really does start to attack the Egyptian agricultural might and strength, and you wouldn't necessarily believe it until you thought about it a little bit more. Kenan. Torah makes a point of saying the kingdom didn't just afflict men and animals, and we'll see why it's important. Why do we care that the kingdom afflict animals? Why are the animals being targeted? We'll see this a bit later. But where else did the kingdom circulate? Look at the psukim. Source 3. Vatia kinam ba'adam uva'beima kol afar ha'aretz haya kinam b'chol eretz Mitzrayim. Let me change your perspective on kingdom, okay? If you think about kingdom, and you call it lice, and you think about maybe when you know, your friend or someone you knew, or maybe yourself had a little lice and it got scratchy, or maybe even some beetles crawling up your body. Imagine grabbing a fistful of dirt and having that entire hole that you've just dug filled with these teeming, streaming insects of all shapes and forms. Make it more gory and more literal, because it wasn't just that they were affecting your body, causing you to scratch a little bit. Anytime you dug out some dirt, that hole became immediately filled with millions of ants, insects, beetles, worms. So we'll talk about a very important industry this affected later. But what's the first industry this affected? Agriculture. You can't plant. What are you going to plant? Every hole you dig to plant a tree, to plant some wheat, becomes filled with bugs and insects. So now it gets a little more dire. Now it's not just the caviar from the Nile that we can't eat, or the ovens that have been shut down for a few months because they smell from reptiles. But now they start. Now they only have one crop left, the crop from that year, because they can't plant any new crops. Now Arov, and now Shchin happens. So Shchin is something very interesting. Again, you'd think, and we'll talk a little bit later about some of the symbolisms of Shchin, you'd think that Shchin doesn't really. But how did Shchin materialize? What did Moshe convert into Shchin? You remember? The ashes of? Not just ashes, are you? But which ashes?
Oven.
The ashes of an oven. So he climbs into an oven, takes the ashes. There's an irony, because in those days they used to use ashes to relieve the effects of shchin. They would cool and soothe themselves up in the ashes. So here he takes ashes and converts them into shchin. If you're an Egyptian, and you've just suffered a week of shchin, a week of venereal disease and boils and pussy, bloody, bloated skin, and you saw all that shchin coming from your oven, how quick do you think you'd be to go back and fire up that oven? I'm not going back. I'd rather eat my fish cold. I'd rather have my cold soup. I'm not getting near my oven again. Because I just saw the soot from my oven create this terrible disease that quarantined me and my entire family. At this point, the ovens don't just smell, they're shut down. So the crops are suffering, the ground is untillable, the ovens have been shut down, and then the last two happen. The last two makos, which completely eliminate any foodstuffs. What am I referring to? Barren and Arba. And the Torah links Barren and Arba, the end of Parshas Va'era, all the crops that Barra didn't get through, the Arba ate, and Tehillim is very clear that these are to be taken as a 1-2 punch, eliminating all the remaining food. Take a look at, take a look at source number 8, the end on the second page. Vayitein lechasil yivulam. This is in Tehillim Parak Ayin Chas. Hashem took their food and eliminated. Lechasil means to destroy. Vigiam and all their hard work. Yaharog babarad gafnam. Hashem murdered their grapes in Barad v'shikmotam and all their crops, bachanamal and grasshoppers. So this interaction between Barad and Arba, which Yehuda Nasi was very aware of. Yehuda Nasi gave the siman, and he wanted Barad and Arba to be together. Why do you say Tzach Adash B'Achav, not Tzach Adash and Achav? Why was it 3-3-4, not 3-4-3 or 4? Because he wanted Barad and Arba to be linked, as the Torah links the two. So now the Egyptians are starving. They have no food to eat, and when you're starving, you know your will has been broken, and your own belief in yourself has been altered. Now we've gone from providers. We used to provide. We used to be energy providers. Now we've gone to paupers begging for our daily bread. So that's a third agenda of the Makos, to strike at the breadbasket, which was the source of Egyptian pride, the source of economic might. And it's not just one Mako. So you see how we're creating connections between Makos, many different connections that aren't encapsulated just by the Tzach HaDash V'Achav, the simple 3-3-4 structure. Another important agenda, I don't know if I'll have time for more than one more, is to reorder social hierarchies. What do I mean to reorder social hierarchies? Part of emancipating the Jewish people is not just emancipating their bodies, but emancipating their spirit. You've been raped, beaten, persecuted, debased, excoriated, ridiculed, you're a slave, you've been whipped, you've been treated like mud. I mean, we don't really have, Baruch Hashem, in modern society, slavery, but a slave is not just hard work, it's a low self-opinion, low self-esteem, you've been abused in every possible way, shape, and form. And the Egyptians are seen as the lords, as the masters, as the noblemen. They walk by in nice clothing. They walk by with a cup of lemonade, someone with a shade, with a fan, with their servants. And that social hierarchy has to be restructured. One of the first moments that it gets restructured is by debasing the Egyptians. Which is the makkah that debases Egyptians? Which is the makkah that turns an Egyptian into an ungroomed, non-hygienic slave? And now he's equal to the other slaves, and he smells, and he... Kenan. Kenan was an attempt to turn an Egyptian into an animal. That's why the Torah stresses, look at Kenan carefully, Vatiya Kinam, source number 3, Vatiya Kinam ba'adam uva behema. Hashem didn't place Kenan on the behema. Behemas have Kenan. That's how they live. You ever seen a horse wag its tail trying to get the flies away? Horses and animals and elephants live with insects. By afflicting the Egyptians with insects, they became like animals. Hashem didn't send supernatural kingdom to the animals. The animals have kingdom naturally. The Egyptians were afflicted with kingdom. They saw themselves now as animals. And not only did they see themselves as animals, but who are they like now? Don't be afraid to say it. They were like the Jews who had Kenan because they were slaves. The Jews didn't need Kenan to have Kenan. They had Kenan. They couldn't shower. They couldn't keep their hygiene. Which is why, unlike Arov and Dever, in which there are clear attempts to divide the Jews from the Egyptians, when the Torah describes Arov, it says that the place of Be'amor is Eretz Goshen. Goshen will not have Arov. V'samti pedus ben ami uvein amecha. Am Yisrael will not be afflicted by Arov. In the case of Dever, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, V'hifla Hashem b'miknei Yisrael, V'yamas kol miknei Mitzrayim, v'miknei b'nei Yisrael lames, Arov and Dever, ah, the Egyptians had it, the Jews didn't. In Kenan, there's no attempt to distinguish the Jews. The Jews weren't afflicted by Kenan, they possessed Kenan because they were slaves. And now the Egyptian was being debased and downgraded to the status of a slave / animal. Vatiya kinam ba'adam. Ba'adam is universal. It didn't afflict the Egyptians. By product of sending kinam to the Egyptians, now everyone was in the same boat. Vatiya kinam ba'adam uva be'ma uva chalafar arts. Second of all, second makkah which debases, and that's why kinam has no warning. One of the reasons kinam has no warning is if you want to teach someone a theological lesson, you have to telegraph the lesson beforehand so it'll be able to connect the dots. Oh, you're the creator. Now I see Bar. Oh, my Nile is not the god I see now being repudiated. But if you want to embarrass someone and debase them, you can't warn them. It has to be a surprise. If I say I'm going to embarrass you, 10 minutes I'm going to embarrass you, you won't be embarrassed because you'll be prepared for it. Part of embarrassment is when you see yourself as one way and suddenly it's all changed. So Kenan can't have a warning because it's meant to debase Egyptians. Another makkah which can't have a warning which debases Egyptians is Shechem. Now, Shechem debases the Egyptians for two reasons. Again, we tend to sanitize it. It's just little boils. And this was a mass spread of an STD, of a sexually transmitted disease. It was bubbling. The Torah makes a clear sense of bubbling and bloody and ababuos. Everyone had to run away because you had to basically live by yourself. Shechem is the classic, classic disease for suffering. Who gets Shechem most infamously as part of his suffering? Anyone know? Yov. Yov, in the beginning of Sefer Yov, is afflicted with Shechem. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us in Parshas Kisavo that Hashem will punish us and make us suffer, Yakecha Hashem b'Shechem uva'shachepes uva'kadacha. Shechem is the classic. Shechem is the only makkah that's classic that Hashem sends to people who deserve, or we don't know that they deserve, people that are going to suffer from the divine hand of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But it also debased the Egyptians because it debunked another part of the Egyptian hierarchy. We're not going to have enough time to iterate the different levels of Egyptian society, because it wasn't one monolithic Paro. It was a conspiracy of many different gangs and many different layers, which is why the Arov is important, but that's for a different time. But one very important paranoble layer of Egyptian society were the Khartoumim, were these magicians. Magicians were noblemen. They were part of the Egyptian hierarchy. They weren't just, magicians performing in Las Vegas. They were noble. They were Paro's advisors. He asks them to interpret his dreams. He asks them for counsel. He asks them for advice. And they fail in Canaan. And they're amazed by Dever. It's a slow process. But when it comes to Shlin, A, they're defeated by a bigger magician. Who's a bigger magician in Shlin? Who makes believe he's a magician? Moshe. This is a magic show. Why did Moshe just stick his arm out and call Shlin from the heavens? He gathers some dust. He flings it to heaven. You and I both know that you can't really throw dust to heaven. It doesn't go too high. It doesn't have that much weight. Gravity will pull it down pretty quickly. You can't really throw it that high. But it spreads throughout all of Egypt, and then it descends, and miraculously, Moshe is acting as a magician. In part because he wants to mock the Egyptian magicians. And when I show you this, if you look carefully, Torah makes a point of saying, source number 6, line 3, V'lo yachlu ha-chartumim la'amod lifnei Moshe, lifnei Hashem. This is a double entendre. They couldn't stand in front of Moshe, A, because Shlin also affects your joints. Shlin is a rheumatoid infection. They literally couldn't stand. They couldn't stand because they have to be quarantined. They were hustled off to their quarantine rooms. But the metaphor is they couldn't stand in front of Moshe. They had been out-magicianed. These magicians have been out-magicianed. They start running away, crying, and now this layer of Egyptian society that assisted Paro in enslaving and persecuting the Jews now has been mocked and ridiculed. They're running off crying back to their quarantine rooms. And now Egyptian society, not just the Egyptian human beings as individuals, Egyptian society has been reordered. I'll just end because we're running out of time. Part of the reordering of social hierarchies is not just to lower the Egyptian self-image, but to resuscitate the Jewish spirit and to create a sense of self-esteem among slaves who have been abused and persecuted and trampled upon and exploited. Part of this begins, believe it or not, in the third Makkah. How does Canaan resuscitate Jewish pride? It resuscitates the pride because one of the industries to be affected by Canaan was not just agriculture. What else is affected by Canaan? You have no dirt. You have no sand. Every time you start digging, it gets filled with insects. Which industry halts?
Burial.
But that's not an industry.
Construction.
Construction. You have no solid ground to build it. And you have no sand to turn to cement, to brick. Why is it important that the construction industry halts? Well, first of all, it strikes another blow at the Egyptians, but more important, it's striking a blow at the Egyptians. Who's off from work now? Jews. Jews have to shut off from work. At that point, the slavery ends. Because they can't continue with building materials. There's no land to build on. Well, it's not at a very early stage. The Jews are no longer being persecuted in the physical sense. What happens in Dever? Very important in Dever. Part of the outcome of Dever, because all the Egyptians lost their cattle. But the Torah makes a point of saying, if you take a look at source number 5, and it stresses, V'lo yamos mikol b'nei Yisrael davar, play on the words of Dever, not one single animal, not one davar, was killed, and the Torah repeats it. Vayas Hashem es hadavar hazem b'macharas, vayamos kol miknei Mitzrayim, u'miknei b'nei Yisrael lo meis echad. So now the Egyptians are seen as failed shepherds because all their animals have died. And who are seen as successful shepherds? Jewish people, because all their animals have survived. Why is that important? Hey, wait a second. A long time ago, before we were enslaved, what were we? How did we descend to Egypt? We were shepherds. That was our trade. That was our family's heritage. Before it was taken away from us. Before we were coerced to build pyramids and to be persecuted and to be abused. We're really good shepherds. Oh, we're really good shepherds. We have self-esteem. We're people. We have an identity. We have a national calling. We have history. Shlin also contributed to that. When is the last time an Egyptian received Shechin at the hands of a Jew? Who received Shechin? Avraham and Paro. Oh yeah. It was a long time ago that an Egyptian Paro tried to start up with our ancestor, Avraham. And he received Shechin. And Avraham was rescued from his tentacles. So now that Shechin is happening, we're also going to be rescued. We have a history. We were shepherds. Shechin, well, that's a familiar punishment for Egyptians who try to abuse Jews. So part of it was debasing the Egyptian or Egyptian society. Part of it was restoring Jewish pride. There's several more agendas, we're just running out of time. But what you just see is that this simplistic 3-3-4 and just building sequence is based on the 3-3-4 structure. And seeing the Makos as purely punitive or purely breaking the will of Pyrrhus so that it'll discharge the Jewish people, there's a lot more that's happening. We talked about four, just to summarize. We talked about repudiating Egyptian theology. Dam, Tzvardeya, Bimata, Choshech, Dever. Spoke about introducing some of the terminologies and ideas of monotheism. Whether it's the creation of Kinim and Bar, the coexistence of water and ice, the coexistence of evil, suffering, and compassion, lifting people's attention to the heavens. He spoke about striking at the Egyptian breadbasket. Slow process, not a one-off, but a slow process of removing the fish, shutting down the ovens, taking away next year's crops, shutting down the ovens entirely in Shechin, and then, of course, the fatal duo of Barad and Arpa. We spoke about taking an Egyptian down a few notches, raising a Jew up a few notches, either by embarrassing Egyptians, turning them into smelly, stinking, lice-ridden, insect-ridden animals, like their victims had been, turning them into victims of STDs or of real physical suffering, but equally important, taking a Jew and restoring the sense that I belong to something. Because remember, you were born into slavery. You didn't know a different life if you're that generation, the younger generation, everyone who died. You have to know there was a past. We have a past. And in that past, we were shepherds. And that being a shepherd was important. And in the past, we were defended by a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Egyptians had started up with us. We got in our grill. They were subjected to Shechin. Now we're ready to go out and to reassume the national core. Well, this gives you, feel free to think about some more, because a lot of other things here about Hashem's perspective, how Hashem is seen, about why Arba is meant to, but if you look carefully at the Makos, it's a lot to see and to hear beyond just punishing power. Okay,